It's 8:15. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, at a public hearing last night on the Canyon Corners proposal, which would be anchored by the new location for Whole Foods, half a dozen people spoke, mostly from the Spring Creek neighborhood there on the other side of Interstate 80. They mentioned the impacts that it'll have on their neighborhood, but also mentioned other concerns like traffic. The Canyon Corners parcel across from Ruby Tuesdays and the Hampton Inn received an approval back in 2003 for 7 buildings. Now the applicants are asking for an amended development agreement, which would have 2 buildings. One would be a 43,000-square-foot Whole Foods, including beer and wine pub service, as well as a fast-food-style restaurant. Another building with retail and office would be 18,000 square feet. In the studio with me, a member of the Snyderville Planning Commission, Chuck Klingenstein. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Leslie.
Now, you didn't make a decision, but you did go over a lot of the details. In fact, you and other commissioners noted that you just received a lot of new information on the parcel just yesterday. What, due to a press release that was issued? Or?
Well, I always encourage anybody who's an applicant in the process to get information in early and often to help the staff have information so they can prepare for their staff reports, and that we, the commission, don't sit there digging through all this new information, trying to absorb it, plus listen to a public hearing and meeting. And a boatload of information showed up last night. But, of course, probably the biggest wake-up call was it's not just a Whole Foods, but there was a press release back on May 6th that announced it's going to have a tap room and all the beer and wine, as you mentioned, and a restaurant. And all of a sudden, all this new information that I don't even think the staff had. So it changes a lot of the traffic generation numbers and maybe affordable housing numbers. I don't know until we dig into all the new information.
Yeah. Staff said that they did want another traffic study. Planner Ray Milliner reporting that with the restaurant and the pub, that the traffic impact would be at least 10% more.
Yeah, and I don't know what that number really is. The applicant's traffic engineer stated that it will be more, but they don't think so. I better be careful because I can't remember if he said significantly, but Ray did mention a 10% number. I don't know what the number is going to be, but I think that is one of the defining issues of this project, is understanding traffic generation, internal circulation, external circulation on Landmark Drive. We all know and have experienced that at unique times of the year, whether it's what they call Black Friday before Christmas or getting ready for school, Christmas in general. We don't design roads and transportation systems to peak because they're peak events. But nevertheless, this is an area that's becoming increasingly congested, and it's a very large concern for the entire commission.
Yeah. Since the applicant dropped the access to 224, it has 2 accesses now on Landmark Drive. So are people going to be able to make a left turn out of that? Or are they going to have to go down, make a right down to the outlet mall, the roundabout?
Well, one of the things I brought up last night, and I think the commission said, yeah, that's worth discussing, is they do have 2 access points. One is adjacent to the Ruby Tuesdays, and I forget the hotel there, Hampton Inns, I think, that would be a left-right turn. And then further to the north towards the roundabout, there's a second access point that they're proposing. And I brought up that it might be worth considering that as a right turn only, so that when it backs up internally at the other access exit point, that people have an exit strategy, so to speak, to go down there, make the right-hand turn, go down to the roundabout, and either come around and head back, or just say, I don't want to go back through Kimball Junction and head down towards Quarry Junction.
All right. So how is the site going to deal then with pedestrians, bikers, and the bus system?
You know, there was actually a layout in some of the information we got, and we did ask specifically on the record for a better explanation for pedestrian circulation internally and externally, because while we could see it, we wanted to make sure we fully flesh it out and understand it. And I think they are looking at it. They have been in discussions with the outlet mall about pedestrian connections. But this is another one of those ones we said, you're making good strides, but we have a lot more detailed information that we need. When you start using words like, well, we'd like to do, we may be able to, we would prefer to hear, we are going to have a pedestrian, whatever. We are going to have, we want those power words because that's what's going to get into a development agreement, assuming this gets to a development agreement at some point.
Yeah. Some disagreement between the applicants and staff about whether or not the project has to do affordable housing. What's your opinion? Do they?
I believe that, and I'm just one opinion on a commission, but my read is they probably have an obligation to do it. I asked staff to really tackle that with the applicants, and I believe they'll work out an equitable solution.
Yeah. You had suggested perhaps putting some affordable housing on the roof, but then, of course, you heard from the residents of Spring Creek concerned about the height.
This is one of those classic examples of where public input is so important. You know, I don't necessarily have a problem with height if it's done in the right place in the right way, but that was without the knowledge that Spring Creek brought up and an interesting historical perspective of when the Walmart was built, which they were outside of the 1,000-foot courtesy notice. And I think it's important for all citizens to recognize that we do have a 1,000-foot courtesy notice for certain projects that go through the approval process, but we have mandatory legal notices, and I'm a little rusty on this, Leslie, but you know, I think it's, you know, you publish it in a paper, and I think it's 3 conspicuous locations, and don't hold me to that, but that makes you realize as a citizen that you can't just trust your mail to have things show up and warn you about things. And unfortunately for Spring Creek, they were outside of that 1,000-foot radius. So not only did the visual impact of the new Walmart expansion hit them, but the lighting. And the descriptions of the lighting that we received last night, the bleed-off, especially in a snowstorm, when people have to put up blackout curtains to sleep at night, was, you know, that was testimony that we really appreciated hearing.
So in terms of the affordable housing, I mean, is a number of units being thrown around?
Yeah. There was an initial calculation done that came up with, I believe it was 20.5, what they call AUEs. One AUE, affordable unit equivalent, is 2 bedrooms and 900 square feet. So it's a pretty big number for anybody to tackle. And then this number was based on a grocery, commercial retail type space. And all of a sudden now we have a tap room and a restaurant, and we need to have a better understanding of that because that may change some numbers, not only in traffic, but affordable housing.
Did the applicant talk anything about that's the make or break of the deal?
No, I think they're going through the process. You know, what the one thing the applicant has learned after the last meeting 2 months ago and this meeting is they have a lot of challenges with this site. And they were pretty candid on the record by saying this is an incredibly challenging site.
All right. Let's see. On work session, talk about changing the code to allow some construction in setbacks from lakes, streams, and wet areas. The staff calling for 3 riparian zones, allowing various degrees of construction. Is that a good idea?
You know, it's one of those ones that we had some testimony last night that said, why are we creating any ways for people to do anything in riparian areas? However, if you have existing homes or what they call lots of record, you end up having to allow something if people can prove a hardship. And hardships mean they go to the Board of Adjustments, they prove a hardship, and then they pretty much get to do what they want if they can prove a hardship. This is a way to say, okay, within certain distances, A, B, or C, and I think it was 0 to 50, pretty much nothing. I want to say 50 to 75, very limited, and then there's 75 to 100 feet from the stream. You can do some very limited remodeling to your structure. So it's still not opening the barn door too much. It does have a circuit breaker, which would allow for the development director to take a look at what might potentially become a hardship to try to come up with a way to accommodate a need with some planning solutions that wouldn't allow it to go to the Board of Adjustment, who would get stuck with a hardship and then the horse is out of the barn.
So what's the difference between a riparian area and a wetland?
I was afraid you were going to ask that. You know, wetlands, quite simply, ever since the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has been in charge of wetlands, there has been boatloads of litigation. And as I understand it, they're called U.S. waters of the United States. And any waters of the United States that are connect to navigable streams and rivers are considered jurisdictional wetlands. That's an oversimplistic explanation. But what we're getting into the tricky part is we have these isolated wetlands, which also look like riparian areas. They have wet water, they have vegetation, they have soils, but they're not connected to waters of the U.S. Now, luckily, as a county, we do manage and try to protect riparian areas, the tricky one of these isolated wetlands. And there used to be a way that they actually were controlled by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And then there was this big lawsuit throughout this migratory bird connection. It's incredibly complicated, but the simplest answer I can give you is wetlands, U.S. waters of the United States, riparian areas are adjacent to typical watery areas, but we have these isolated wetlands that we're still struggling with.
So, I mean, have you kind of delineated who's in charge of what? I mean, do you know which ones are the wetlands that would be enforced by?
Well, we do have Ray Milner was the planner on this one. He basically said the second we take a look at something, we have a GIS layer that turns on waters of the U.S. and turns on all the wetlands out there. The concern expressed by some of the commission, I think we're all concerned about, are these riparian areas and these isolated wetlands. And you know, we received some good testimony saying, you know, some jurisdictions have tried to take a shot at it. I don't know if we're going to, I would say we're going to evaluate all of our options at this point.
Okay. Anything else?
No. Happy to be here. And thanks, Leslie.
Thanks, Chuck. Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner Chuck Klingenstein. KPCW News Time now, 8:27. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Joining me now in the studio, Park City Manager Diane Foster, along with Nate Rockwood, the Debits, Grants, and Capital Budgets Manager. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's first start with you, Diane. A huge update from kind of the construction liaison, Craig Sanchez. Let's talk briefly about some bike paths that we're talking about building there along Park Avenue.
We are. This is part of the walkability project, still continues, and we are. This is the Dan's to Jan's or Fresh Market to
the market.
Yeah, market, whatever. Along Route 224 to improve walkability. And at the same time, staff thought it would be possible to go ahead and do some work along Deer Valley Drive, kind of in front of Frontier Bank in that area.
Okay. Lots of road projects, slurry seals that. It's all been determined by the capital projects
budget. It has been. We have a short building season here, and I'll tell you, when Tom Backley moved to Hermosa Beach and he got a paving contract in December, he nearly fell off his chair and said, "You can't do that." So,
yeah, you can. Any idea where we are on the snow hut? I heard that it's actually been demolished.
It's been demolished, and in fact, there's a great video on Facebook that you can go watch. It apparently came down in 2 hours, so they have both. The building department has issued a demolition permit for the snow hut as well as the grading permit. So they've demolished that. It's my understanding from some folks up there that they went in and reclaimed and recycled whatever they could at first, and then they tore it down with a big track hoe.
Okay, so it wasn't like it burned to the ground. That would have been a lot easier than having to haul all that stuff off the mountain, no?
Right, yeah, no, they took it down with a track hoe. It's a fun video to watch, and if you have kids, that'll be a good one.
All right. Rocky Mountain Power Project there along Deer Valley Drive, I was reading in the staff report that basically the power's off in town to be able to do that. So we're relying on the substation in Snyderville, so just kind of keeping our fingers crossed that nothing happens there.
We are keeping our fingers crossed. The emergency services staff, as well as Matt Castle, the city engineer, have been spending a lot of time with Rocky Mountain Power. And in addition to, you know, having coming through the Snyderville Basin substation, and remember, a lot of communities actually only have one power source. Like my neighborhood only has one source of power. But as a city, we are keeping, we have taken extra measures in case we do have something happen. As you know, a lot of our facilities have very large generators, and that includes Quinn's Water Treatment Plant, the police facility, as well as the Marsac building. So we feel confident that if something were to happen, which we hope it will not, but if something were to happen, that we'll be operational.
Okay. So you couldn't get them to paint the big tower there on Bonanza?
It's
the old rusted
really
one?
Bad. I was looking at it the other day. We'll keep asking.
All right. Let's turn to the budget. Over the last several weeks, the budget details will keep appearing here at City Council meetings. So where are we now? I mean, are we just tweaking it, Nate?
Yeah, I mean, we've presented and actually adopted the city manager's recommended budget. So at this point, we're just presenting different aspects to council. Then they're able to review that, make any tweaks, and then we'll make those adjustments and then adopt the final budget. So that's where we are in the process.
All right. So at this point, Diane, you are not recommending any tax increase?
We are not recommending a tax increase at this juncture.
All right. I noted that $31 million in funding over the next 5 years has been set aside for affordable, attainable, middle-income housing. I noticed several references to, like, Lower Park Avenue. I mean, have we decided that that's where all of this is going?
No, and in fact, on May 19th, I put it on your calendar. I believe it starts at 6 p.m. at the Yarrow, or I guess that's now the DoubleTree Hotel on Park Ave. We will be holding the first of what will be several community forums, and at that one, you'll have an opportunity to provide some input on what you think Lower Park Ave should be. So City Council has decided at 1450, 1460 that there will be somewhere between 6 and 8 units at that site, and staff is already working fast on the actual design. They'll be coming back with that within the next 4 weeks to ask council. Council asked staff to come back with either a cottage design or a townhome design, and council will take a look at that. So that's on the fast track. We believe that City Council will want to have some housing there, if not a lot of housing there. That's been the long-term plan, but the council very much wants to hear from the community. So there'll be a series of forums, the first being May 19th at the Yarrow, and then we'll see some in mid-July as well.
Mm-hmm. So this $31 million, is that to build houses, or are we actually talking about property acquisition to
it's
do that?
It's both. It's going to be property acquisition and building houses. So there's several programs that are in there. One thing to note about the funding source on those is that a lot of them do say the Lower Park RDA, and within RDA code in the state of Utah, you could actually use those funds outside of the boundaries of the RDA if it's for affordable housing. And so it's a combination of using those funds, using some of the additional resort sales tax funds to go and find places where some land acquisition might be possible. So there's a variety of different programs that are in there, and some of them sort of pilot programs that we're going to try out.
And I note that also there's a couple of residential projects being proposed along Prospector Avenue, a place where city council members have said more density probably could be handled. I mean, the city couldn't use some of that money to build more units there and have those as affordable units? I mean, since the construction's already going to be done.
The city absolutely can. You know, what I love about this plan is, number one, it provides council the opportunity to put money against their critical priority. So they've identified transportation and housing, middle income, affordable income, and attainable housing as their top priorities. Number two, the other reason it's great is that it's a multi-channel approach. So it's not just, as Nate said, not just one thing. So it is property acquisition. It's home acquisition. So there's a piece called the Neighborhood Preservation Program. And if you look at communities like Aspen, where they've had what were traditionally residential neighborhoods flip and become primarily and sometimes exclusively second homes, we do want Park Meadows to be a residential neighborhood. So there may be opportunities to go in and buy homes there and either tear them down and build something new or simply acquire them and sell them at a little bit less than they were purchased for and then deed restrict them. So there are going to be, and also the city does have property that City Council very much wants to look at should we be building homes on it.
Hmm. Nearly $5 million has been budgeted for open space. Are we buying a lot of open space that we could be building affordable housing on?
You know, I remember when I first came to town back in 2000, I was talking to Miles Radiman, and I was part of the leadership program, and I was surprised when he said that affordable housing and open space are often at odds. I didn't really understand it at the time. And what I understand now is when you buy a piece of land and you preserve it, well, that is of critical importance to the community, and obviously our city council and staff are huge supporters of open space. it does mean you can't build anything on it, including affordable housing. So sometimes, so as a community, we do have to make choices. You know, I believe the community has done and the city has done a fabulous job, as well as the land preservation organizations have done an amazing job at preserving open space. It doesn't mean we're done, but the large tracts of land that have been that were available are generally gone at this point. And so looking at a small piece of property, now some of it, the city and the land conservancies will definitely want to look at it for wildlife quarter. Those are very important, as we learned from our local bear. But there are places that may be smaller lots or infill lots that are most appropriate for housing.
You know, you mentioned transit as being one of the critical priorities, but the only thing I see is about $300,000 to go towards the Park City Mountain Resort Transit Center.
The time frames for transit are different than for housing. We have four requests for proposals in process right now. Some of them are actually underway in work, and that has to do with everything from 224 to 248 to looking where's the most appropriate place to do parking. There is so much work going on the transit front right now, but they don't have the same immediate demand for funding. Additionally, a lot of that funding some of it will come out of the transit fund. And wherever possible, we will get grants to do that work. So I don't. I agree with you that the $32 million for housing is a significant commitment. I think in the coming years we will absolutely see that on the transit front. Additionally, transit has we've got over 400 units in the community of affordable housing, which is I believe impressive. Transit is a lot further along when you think about the state of our bus system. We have one of the most sophisticated small-town bus systems in the country. It's free. There's a wonderful app. We're in a different place.
All right. Another big chunk of change, though, is budgeted for $47 million in water projects over the next 5 years. We're talking about the Prospector Dam and the storm water improvements.
Yeah, those aren't actually even included in that.
47?
Yeah, that's not included in the 47. 47 is for water improvements, and so those are going towards things like improving the Spiro and just continuing to do that, upgrading that system.
The other piece that includes is we will in the coming years have the single largest water project in the state, and that's the legal requirements that are being placed upon us by the state for the Judge Tunnel outflow. So making that, bringing that up to our stream water quality.
So are we bonding for this, or we're just, you know, ratepayers are paying for it?
Well, it's both. We're bonding for it, and the ratepayers are paying off the debt on the bond. So that's a continued process. We've issued bonds pretty much every year for the last 5 or 6 years, and that'll continue as we look to make those improvements.
All right. And then I also noticed for $1.3 million a soils repository. Do we even have approval from the EPA to move forward with something like that?
That's money that's been in there for the soils repository, just money that's been saved pending where that's going to go. So that's been in there for several years and continues to just sort of carry forward as we try to come to a resolution of what that's going to be.
Okay, so we really don't have any plan at this point.
No.
An idea, but no plan.
Not right now.
Okay. Let's see. The WaterSmart program, we had the warmest and driest winter in history, but not declaring a drought. How come?
Not yet. We haven't reached that point, although, and we're all thrilled with, you know, while I really want to get back on the trails this weekend, it's okay that it's going to rain again. And while it's definitely helping the groundwater, I think we could have a summer like last summer, right, where we had a lot of rain all summer. If that happens, we won't be in that situation. If the pattern we had this past winter continues, I have no doubt that we would be, that the city council would be declaring restrictions.
All right. Staff's also making recommendations for changing curbside pickup recycling in Old Town. One more time here. What's a problem now, or people are doing it right? Or
this was a city council request. They had many complaints from residents about people not bringing in their garbage cans or what are called toters. So we do have an ordinance right now about when they have to be brought in, but City Council wanted to look at making that more strict. Additionally, because we have so many renters in town or nightly rentals, a lot of times the garbage cans get mixed up. And so there was, who do you hold responsible for that? So staff has included some information about you can tag these with RFID as well as doing some more visible address tagging so that we can tighten up on that.
All right. You'll also get a report with regard to the Sundance Film Festival economic report. Have you seen a draft of that or a copy of it?
I have not. I'm an ex officio member of the Utah Advisory Board for Sundance, and they discussed it on Monday. But I was in interviews for the community development director position, so that I missed that. So Sarah Pierce is going to come in and give council the sneak peek at how we did this year.
All right. We'll be talking to her at this time tomorrow, so you can stay tuned for that. Thanks. Also wanted just to ask you this whole notion that we've been talking about the last week about this every other day use on the trails, dogs on, dogs off. I'm after talking with one recreation advisory board member, basically I was told that it's up to Mountain Trails Foundation because the city has delegated all policy decisions to Mountain Trails Foundation. But is this a city decision or not?
I believe that's still the purview of the city council. And Mountain Trails Foundation is a fabulous partner. We work closely with Charlie and very much have a great relationship there. Where we're at the city on off-leash dogs and on these types of considerations of every other day is that, like the county this week is considering changing their anti-idling ordinance to match the city, we're looking at, and staff is going to be bringing to council, changing our ordinance within the city limits so we can allow off-leash dogs. So that would mean we would change our ordinance to match the county. That's step one. And in talking to Heinrich Dieters yesterday, he's looking at bringing that, I think, within the next 6 weeks, bringing that item to council. And then we can sit down and talk about, council has in the past talked about an interest in creating maybe a 30-acre off-leash dog area, something like Run Amok that the county has that's been quite successful. It's a terrific model. And could we create that in Round Valley? Obviously, you have to work with Cheryl Fox and the Summit Land Conservancy on that, as well as with Charlie Sturgis. But with regard to policy direction on property that's controlled by the city, that is still the purview of City Council.
Okay. The deal is, though, the law is that dogs may not be off-leash. If they are off-leash, it's against the law unless they're in a enclosed dog park.
That's correct.
So you really couldn't do anything like that unless you enclose. If we're talking about the Round Valley area, you'd have to enclose the entire Round Valley area to meet the intent of the law.
Absolutely.
And so we're talking about doing that?
We are. So as the city, we will be bringing back to council for consideration, do you want to have off-leash dog areas, number one? And then step two will be, and if they do want that, we'll come back quickly with what would you like to see? Timing-wise, that would mean that the earliest we'd have something in place would likely be 2016 just because of construction fencing, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And would it be an every other day deal, though, so that people could enjoy the trails without dogs?
That would be a decision of City Council.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, please put on your calendar May 19th to come talk to us about what you'd like to see in Lower Park Ave on the city-owned property.
Okay. That's this coming Tuesday.
Terrific.
All right. Diane and Nate, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
The Colony Award.
It's 8:45. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. In the studio with our monthly Summit County Health Department update, I have Katie Mullally. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning, Leslie.
We're going to talk today about the Women's Infant and Children's Program, known as WIC.
Yes.
Yeah, something
what
the
that
health department.
Is, it's a national program that's a food supplemental program for women who are pregnant and breastfeeding and children up to the ages of 5. And it's a very effective program, provides breastfeeding support, nutritious foods, education, referrals to healthcare and social services. And right now in Summit County, we have 524 participants, which may sound like a lot, but we always have room for more. And so we want to get the word out that these services are available. There are federal income guidelines that you have to hit, but if you're a family that's receiving food stamps or on Medicaid, you've already qualified. And so we want to get the word out for people to come see us, schedule appointments. It really helps with women make sure that they have the proper nutrition while they're pregnant, for small children as they're developing. And for, you know, older children up to the ages of 5, they can help them with foods for school, for alertness, for health.
So how does it work? I mean, is it the county like a food bank, or do you actually give them vouchers and they purchase their own?
We give them vouchers. And so they come in, set up an appointment. They evaluate what foods they need, everything from formulas to peanut butters and bread, milk, variety of nutritious foods, vegetables and fruits. They receive vouchers. There are a few grocery stores in the county that we partner with, and they take the vouchers into the stores. When we had the federal shutdown a couple of years ago, we were scrambling to get foods for these families because since it was federally funded, it was shut down for a short amount of time. But we were able to continue with the help of community partners to make sure these families had the foods they needed.
All right. So how do people apply?
What they can do is either go to summitcountyhealth.org and look at the income guidelines and find if they fit. Or they can call 333-1517, and that puts them in touch with the WIC director. And she can also do an on-phone evaluation, a discussion to see if this program will fit their needs.
Okay. And let's see. Also, it's bike season, and you've got some reminders for kids.
Exactly. It is bike season. And, you know, as a community, we always want to encourage everyone to be out on their bikes, and that includes children. And as adults who are either biking past or driving past kids, we forget that their skills aren't as highly developed as ours. And I found some great information, and they were saying that kids ages 5 to 9, they have a lot less coordination for pedaling. They have a lot that's harder for them to recognize obstacles and avoid them, and they really lack hand-eye coordination. And so as you're driving down the road and you see that kid pedaling, albeit somewhat awkwardly, be sure and give them a lot of space, because they're not going to be aware of a car coming around them or another biker. And then I found that kids 10 to 14 have problems. They're not fully able to distinguish objects in a distance. And so if you come upon them, they can't pick you out. So whenever you see our youngest riders, be sure and understand that they're not as highly developed in their biking skills. And then also on our site, under the active transportation, we've got some great information on making sure that a kid's bike fits properly. And so you can go on that and download some information, because you see a lot of kids with bikes that aren't quite suited for them.
Okay.
And then
anything else?
One quick reminder, you know, with the Pooches on Patios, we've got 6 restaurants that have signed up and have their permits. But also to support the restaurants that have it and take pressure off of the restaurants that don't have the permit. As a dog owner, if you want to bring your dog with you, please go to these restaurants that are permitted. It makes it a lot easier for everybody. The restaurants that aren't permitted don't either have to ask you to leave or run the risk of being fined. And the restaurants that do have that, they get the rewards. And if you go to summitcountyhealth.org, there is a link and a list of all of the restaurants that have been permitted.
Okay. Have you had any problems that you had to ticket people for?
Not yet. I think because it's been early season. Been cold. A lot of restaurants have been closed, but like I said, we've got 6 restaurants already that have signed up and want to really support them for doing that.
Okay. Anything else?
No, that's it, Leslie.
Okay.
Thank you.
See you next month. Katie Mullally with the Summit County Health Department. 10 minutes now before 9 o'clock. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Joining me now in the studio with the Youth Sports Alliance, I have Director Amy Preston. Good morning. So kind of a downtime for you, but lots going on in the background here in terms of raising money. And
we had a great year. Last year we launched the Stein Erickson YSA Opportunity Endowment, which has a campaign goal of $2 million over 2 years. We're already $1.4 million into that. We awarded the most ever scholarships that we ever have, which was about 48,000 in competitive scholarships and another 30,000 in our introductory after school get out and play program scholarships. So we really did a good job of getting those kids in financial need out there and active. And then we also awarded to our teams more than we ever have in the past. We increased our number to about $270,000 in funding, and we granted them monies to cover a lot of different things like coaches travel, coach education, safety netting for courses, new technologies to improve performance for the kids, and a high performance training center that the Park City Ski Team is running. So we've done a lot of that. We started a new pilot program with Get Out and Play this year with mountain biking, and partnered with Young Riders who they're coaching that program. Camelpack and Goo came on board to help provide backpacks and energy for the kids. They're doing a great job. They're in their third week this Friday, and they have one more week after this. But the pilot program has 49 kids in it, and we're getting calls every day of kids that want to sign up. So we're hoping to offer that again in the fall and next spring. So lots of things going on. We're in the planning phase and the fundraising phase, so we can be able to offer the same amount of support we had this year, next year. We have a new event on the docket this year. We're doing a golf tournament. We're partnering with the Canyons and their new golf course. So that is going to be June 19th. And we're starting to sign up teams at this point right now. So the golf course was designed by Gene Bates and Casey Bates, and it's a par 70 course. It's very challenging, and I think it's got a lot of fun items to it that, this will be the first tournament on that course, so it'll be a good time to get to know that course. So it'll cost $250 per person or $1,000 per team, and we have sponsorships available and a lunch reception that will be up there. And we already have secured some great prizes for that tournament, the hole-in-one prizes of Rolex and an Infiniti car and lots of other stuff rolling in right now at this point. So if people are interested in that, there's more information at our website, ysaparkcity.org, and you can always call our office or look us up online, and we can get you all the information to get signed up for that.
Okay, I wanted to ask you real quick, the teams, that you hand out that $270,000, mm-hmm. do they need to apply for specific funding, or is it just based that you just hand it out based on participation numbers? Or
no, so we actually work really closely with the teams. We have a criteria set forth for them to be member teams. They have to have a list of things, a business license, file their 990s on time every year, and we look at their budgets, and then they participate in the fundraising events, and part of their funding is based on their participation, and then the other part of their funding is they have to look at what their needs are, and they look at their budget. What am I missing? What can I do to help improve my program? And they apply for a grant, just like you would with RAPTAX or the Park City Community Foundation. And then we have a committee that's composed of our board members, and they look at those, at the needs across the teams, and they award those grant funds based on what they think is most necessary at the time.
Is that done on an annual basis or twice
a year?
It is.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's done on an annual basis. So after we raise, most of our money comes from Jan's Winter Welcome. And you guys hear a lot about that all year long. So Jan's Winter Welcome. And then once that is raised in November, we give out the grants to the teams.
Okay. And so you've set a date already for Jan's Winter Welcome.
We did. So we are back to Stein Erickson Lodge. That we had a great event there last year. Last year was the Monaco Grand Prix theme, and those people who won that trip are getting ready to go in the next couple of weeks. They're super excited. So I'll be giving you an update on how that trip went. But this year we're October 24th at Stein Erickson Lodge. And we're working on a package to the French Open in tennis. So that will be super exciting. If you think you want to go to the French Open this year, make sure you keep an eye on what we're doing and the package we're putting together, because they're really special packages.
Okay. Anything else?
No, I just our teams did great this year. Our board met yesterday, and we're in the planning phases, and things are going great with our organization. If you have any questions or you'd like to support the organization, you can go to ysaparkcity.org.
Okay. Hey, Amy, thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
It's Amy Preston, the Executive Director of the Youth Sports Alliance. KPCW News Time now, 8:56.
This Youth Sports Alliance report is funded in part by USANA Health Sciences, offering a personal approach to nutrition, business, and customer care. USANA.com.
Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Assemble Park City, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.